Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm doing an impression of Joe Devine, and today I am joined by Joe Devine doing an impression of someone else. Hello, Joe.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. I don't understand the impression you're doing, though.
This is UOL. It's only for visual viewers, not audio listeners. But this is a thing you do. It's a wave. Anyway, I'm well. Thanks for having me on as a guest today on my own podcast.
And as I understand it, you'll be doing lots of tactical analysis. And
I absolutely will. Sometimes I like to step into the shoes of the people that work below me. And I have done that with you today. I'm going to show you basically how you can, you know, engage better with the audience. And main thing I'm going to do is speak a lot more slowly than you speak so that people can understand the high quality tactical analysis that I'm going to give them.
Joe thinks I'm coming for his job. I'm also joined today by the enthusiastic Nick Miller. Hello, Nick.
Hello, JJ. Basically, what Joe just said there is he's a control freak and he can't bear to, you know, leave us to do any of this.
It's true, and he beats me sometimes. He doesn't do that, I should be clear. You went to the football this weekend.
I did. Derby County against Nottingham Forest. Some quite low-level football in terms of quality, but, you know, a fun time was had by all. By which I mean me and my dad.
And the Graham Shinney, Scott McKenna derby, of course. Is what
yeah,
it was.
As it was trailed, yes, by you, just then.
Two excellent ex-Aberdeen players. But we are also joined by the, what's the best word to use here? Glorious. Seb Stafford-Bluer, who joins us from Germany. Hello, Seb.
Hello, JJ Bo.
Did you have a nice weekend also?
I did. I watched a lot of football, ate a lot of food, didn't really leave the house. It was raining very heavily in Germany. So, yeah, I had fun. I feel like I shouldn't admit that amounted to a fun weekend, but it did.
Well, it's good you watched lots of football because we're going to talk about lots of football today. Mostly from the Premier League, occasionally from abroad, from the foreign lands. Places like Spain, France, and is Germany in there?
Germany is a foreign land. Yeah, it's among like that sort of group of countries bracketed as foreign lands. Might talk about a little bit about Dortmund. That might be interesting. Talk a little bit about PSG and Lionel Messi and that team they were playing that nobody can pronounce and that I'm not going to try to pronounce. And hey, maybe do a little bit of Villarreal Atletico Madrid because that finished in a very, very funny way, which we shall discuss.
That sounds good. And I'm not entirely knowledgeable, clued up on all of those teams. But you know what I would do if I wanted to be, Nick?
Would you by any chance subscribe to The Athletic?
I would subscribe to The Athletic. And for a limited time, I keep saying that, it's all of the time, it seems to be, you can go to theathletic.com/TIFO. And right now there is a deal, 30 days of a free trial. Not a free trail, a free trial. And if you like The Athletic after that, and you will because it's great, then you can subscribe afterwards for an amount of money. And if you don't want to, then that's also fine. It's really up to you, but there's some great articles in there, like Joey D'Urso's piece on a duck who was given a minute's applause this week.
Keith the duck. Forever in our hearts.
Do you have an opinion on Keith the duck?
No, I do, but I best keep it to myself.
What you said earlier.
Yeah, best keep it to myself.
Well, that's good. Well, I like Keith the duck. And I think that's a fine way to move on to the actual podcast about football with no ducks, because the only duck that should really matter is the Mallards. So now I'm going to leave you in the cool hands and the warm embrace of Joe Devine, Nick Miller and Seb Stafford-Bluer. Manchester City 5-0 Arsenal. Beyond all of the obvious points, I read, soft Arsenal, typical Arsenal, they are rubbish. Can we talk about the midfield two that they began this game with? Seb Stafford-Bluer, please tell me who the midfield two were that Arsenal started the game against Man City.
Well, originally a midfield two, becoming midfield one after Granit Xhaka got him sent off, but originally he lined up alongside Martin Odegaard, which felt weird. Like if you were going to the Etihad and you had defensive issues, key defensive components injured or absent, I think I might be a little bit more cautious in my midfield selection, particularly when neither of those players are, well, Odegaard's not really paid to be disciplined. Xhaka is, but he's not. and it was just a...
Welcome back to Arsenal, play next to Granit Xhaka in a two against Man City.
But isn't that how, beyond all the stuff about soft Arsenal, crap Arsenal, aren't they going to get hammered Arsenal, didn't everybody read that team selection and just get a little bit of a shiver of fear for them? I mean, not me, for a few reasons, but like it was asking for trouble. It was...
What was it? It's 5-4-1. Looks like it. So he changed system to match up with Man City. But then you've got Odegaard, who sets 10 with Xhaka, and then Xhaka was gone, so you don't have a midfield now all of a sudden. Nick, can you make sense of Arteta's thinking? Did it make sense tactically to start?
No. It felt like there's a bit in Blackadder where they're talking about going over the top and... how
the season four is it when they're in the
and they're saying, well, we've tried that every single time, but if we try it again, that'll be the last thing that the Germans think, even though it hasn't succeeded at any time before. It was almost like Mikel Arteta thought, well, we're playing a team managed by someone who, if he could, would probably play 10 midfielders, so let's... the last thing he would possibly think for us to try will be to play just one midfielder. And it didn't work. As mentioned, I was at another game at this time and I've watched it back since, but I don't really think I needed to watch it to kind of predict what was going to happen or indeed tell you what actually did happen. It was just so entirely predictable that I could have, could have spent my time doing something else rather than watching this game back.
Can I jump in here too and say that I also didn't watch the game, but I feel I experienced it in the way many fans will have done, which was checking my football score app every 10 minutes or so and fully expecting to see another goal and seeing another goal every time I looked. It's embarrassing.
Isn't that quite an interesting thing about football? You can consume it in different ways now, and one of the ways is that on the bus, not actually watching it.
Yeah.
And I think everyone who didn't watch the game can kind of... there's some sort of games you can work out exactly what's happened without actually seeing the game.
Yeah.
As soon as you see Xhaka red card, you know that he's lunged into someone for no reason.
Yeah, and another way that I consumed this game was through producer Adonis's furious WhatsApp messages in the group about the sort of ongoing calamity of Arsenal. And, he, in that fury was, again, the absolute predictableness of pretty much everything that went on in the game.
The weird thing is, actually, I want to know... does anyone care about Arsenal in Germany that you see, Seb? Like, do you read about it or hear about it?
No, they don't really. I mean, I don't think I've come across any sort of debate or any interest. Yeah. Liverpool are very big because of Jurgen Klopp. And
okay. Because what I was going to ask was, how come Mikel Arteta seems to still not be... I mean, I think there's certain Arsenal fans who've started to maybe not be best pleased with him, but I don't see it anywhere else. But it seems to be constantly that he's...
Talk of Conte has ramped up a little bit with fans only, last week or so. Maybe it's just because he's a good manager and available, though.
But if you put Conte into the Arsenal team, surely that would then just... I mean, he wouldn't be where they are just now, would they, Seb?
No, but would Conte take their job? Because if you approach someone who works most often in two or at best 3 year cycles, and you gave him that group of players... maybe they're a little bit better off, but most likely just becomes a very, very unhappy place very, very quickly. And you introduce an element of trauma into the situation, which I don't think Arsenal can really deal with at the moment. Like the one thing that Arteta has in his favour is that he seems to... I don't know whether he's perpetuating this myth to kind of protect his job security, but there's a lot of talk of process, which is one of those words in football which is code for something that... I mean, I'm not even sure what. It's like, well, trust the process. Okay, well, I trust the process when I see what the process actually is or what it might be. Whereas Conte is a bit more process, !, all capital letters. And it's not really process, it's win now or have a massive tantrum and set fire to the building.
Do exactly what I say when I say it. If Conte did take over this group of Arsenal players, it could either reduce them all to sort of gibbering wrecks in the corner, or they could end up like the guys from Fight Club. You know, they initially they come to Tyler Durden, as he says, like wads of cookie dough, and they're kind of these slightly dweeby, a little bit angry, bit flabby guys. And then after 6-7 weeks of Fight Club, they're all kind of bashing the hell out of each other and all ripped up to the eyeballs. So maybe that'll happen.
Yeah.
If Granit Xhaka was that character in Fight Club, he would still be like, he'd be one of those background people. There'd be a fight going on in the foreground.
Even in Fight Club, he'd be asking someone to hold him back.
And, yeah. No. Like, yeah, just definitely hold me back. This is the thing about Granit Xhaka, because we talk about soft Arsenal and weak Arsenal, and then we criticise former club captain and central midfielder for a reckless reducing tackle in the opposition half. And one part of you thinks, yeah, Arsenal could do a little bit of that, could do with a little bit of that. But it's kind of damning of Xhaka that he's so ineffective at that kind of... Mm-hmm. How do you describe it? I think he's a good footballer. Yeah. He just can't get this side of things right.
You watch Fabinho versus Chelsea over the weekend, and the man managed to get away with, I don't know, four or five like yellow card tackles without getting a card because of the way in which he does it, right? Yeah, there is an intelligence to that kind of play, and Xhaka looks more like someone who's lost their head when they do it.
Yeah, he's the anti-Fernandinho, anti-Mark van Bommel. Like, he's the guy that like manages to attract all the attention all at once in a way that really damages his team, which is kind of antithesis of what we think of as kind of smart defensive midfield play now.
He feels like the kind of guy who's read about Fernandinho and Mark van Bommel in a book somewhere and thinks, I should do that. But hasn't
finished the book. Like, he's read part of it. Yeah. Like, read like three chapters and thought, I don't need to finish that.
I'm pretty confident I know what to do. I'm just going to go out and do it. So kick people. Okay, cool.
I'm conscious that we keep slagging off Arsenal, and I think we'll be doing it quite a lot during the season, but we should talk about how good City were. In fact, no, we should talk about how they weren't really good in the first half, but still managed to come up 2-0 and finished 5-0 winners without a striker. And obviously there was a bit of a saga this week with a certain Cristiano Ronaldo who didn't sign. But Ferran Torres, is he the number 9 that they need?
I mean, it looks that way at the moment. He sort of seems to fit the ideal of what Pep Guardiola would want in a number 9, in as much as he wasn't a number 9 and now Guardiola is sort of turning him into one.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a kind of new point, and I'm sure it's been said many, many times before, but the whole Cristiano Ronaldo thing was very strange because I can't think of a player, a less Guardiola player than Cristiano Ronaldo, unless they were sort of planning to use him as some kind of like deluxe Andy Carroll, just to sort of have on the bench and throw on when they needed something, you know.
A plan B.
Yeah, the world's most expensive plan B. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't really tell you what Guardiola has done to make Ferran Torres into, you know, this number 9 that he has. My brain doesn't really work that way. Mm. Someone more tactically minded. JJ.
Well, Joe Devine's here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, listen, what he's done is he's swapped the dinners and lunches that he's been giving to Gabriel Jesus and Torres, because, of course, Torres previously played wide and Jesus played in the middle. That's right, isn't it? And now they play the other place and they're both better. Now, joking aside, I didn't watch this game, but the person I was impressed with in the Man City's previous game was Gabriel Jesus, because he was absolutely incredible on the wing. He did exactly what you want a modern winger to do. His decision-making was perfect. He seemed to know exactly when to cut inside, exactly when to take it down the wing. Mm-hmm. He almost always found a man with a pass. I mean, I cannot believe that I haven't seen him play in that position before. He took to it perfectly.
I think people in Brazil have said that's kind of what he's always wanted to do, but he's just sort of he was bought by Manchester City and sort of showed up, and someone decided he was centre forward, so they've played him at number 9, and you know, he wears number 9, which seems like some sort of you know, when you've known someone for a little while but you don't know, we can't remember what their name is,
sure,
and there reaches a point where it's too awkward to actually ask them what their name is.
That's right, Mark.
Exactly, Steve. It feels like that's what's sort of happened with Gabriel Jesus. They've put him at centre forward, and it's only now that they've thought, oh no, actually we probably should play him where he wants to play.
I mean, he's like a new player though. I think I was of the opinion before, somebody who doesn't watch City every single game, I'm not an expert on Gabriel Jesus, but watching him sort of waste away, as far as a Man City player can waste away, a player who you bring him on and he scores a goal every other time he's a substitute, but doesn't seem to be fulfilling the huge expectation and promise that he had at the beginning. But he seems like a new player. He seems like someone who could now fit into almost any other Premier League team, any top team on the right-hand side. It's amazing, JJ.
Yes. I also remember when he played for City against Real Madrid. I think it was maybe the first leg when they were in the Bernabeu or Bernabeu. I don't know how you pronounce that one, but that one. And he played a very diligent role on the left where he was essentially an extra wing back.
Yeah.
Which is not what you think a number nine does.
No.
So well done to Pep Guardiola getting all of that out of him. That's...
Well, I mean, I would say well done, Gabriel Jesus. It seems like Pep's been playing him in the wrong place for three, 4 years.
It's all the manager's problem at Arsenal. It's all the manager's gain at Man City. That's how it works.
Yeah.
So let's move on now to Liverpool 1-1 Chelsea, which is a game that I watched in the Old Red Lion Theatre pub.
Best pub in London.
It's a lovely pub to watch the football in. I enjoyed it. And I saw the game. And I think what we should ask on this, even though it's quite mainstream and probably going to be covered in every other podcast in the world.
It's the question to ask.
It's the question, yeah. Seb, was that a penalty? And if it was a penalty, was it a red card?
Of course. I the rule is difficult and I don't like penalty red card. Just on principle, I think it ruins a game. But the amount of people raging against it was a little bit strange because that's always a red card. Whenever you have a player... on a goal line and his ball makes contact with a hand, I think I was about to say. That should definitely be a red card. If that happens, that is a red card. Anyway, if his hand makes contact with the ball, then you have no choice. And sometimes, especially on social media, actually, sometimes it feels like we expect part of a referee's job to be to maintain the balance of a game and to sort of overlook rules. I completely agree that referees shouldn't go out of their way to influence a game. But if that hadn't been a red card, I don't think you can defend the referee for not giving it. I think if you had the opportunity to change the rule and made that a yellow card and a penalty, I think that's absolutely fine. Unless it's one of those ridiculous ones where he sort of Suarez's the ball out of the top corner or, you know, out of the sort of as he did against Ghana. Yeah, you have to give that as a red card.
Joe Devine, I bet you have a reasonable analysis or opinion on this penalty.
The rule is wrong. The rule is a stupid, stupid rule, and it's wrong. And Seb's absolutely right. I think people on social media, very, very important. I think maybe there was some misunderstanding about whether or not it was the correct decision or not. Obviously, the decision is correct. It's not the referee's fault. The rule is wrong and stupid. And Seb's absolutely right. If it's a Suarez incident, if it is entirely intentional, and we can say that for sure in the case of Suarez, for example, or Thierry Henry, indeed, we could say that too, then of course it's a red card because it's an egregious act. But in this case, I cannot understand how anybody can say that that is definitely intentional. It's not possible to assume intent from the footage that we have. Therefore, we have to assume innocence in that case. His arm moves in a natural way. It's not unnatural. I understand the thing about it pushing it forward. I get that his arms move towards the ball.
I can't see who anyone thinks it's a
It's foul. Obviously not deliberate. You try having a ball kicked at your knee and then at your arm in a split second and not move your arm in that way. And then to have 100 people telling me on Twitter, oh, it's obviously deliberate. How is it deliberate?
People
how can anyone say that? I understand that the decision is correct. It's correct. But the rule is a stupid rule and should be removed. And that is a shame because that was a wonderful game. And yeah, no one can tell me that Chelsea wouldn't have won that game. I am not a Chelsea fan. I don't care whether they win or not, but they were very impressive in the first half, and it was an exciting game. Liverpool had a fantastic start, but were on the back foot towards the end of that half. And I think it's just ridiculous. Ridiculous. I was angry at home about that.
I was angry in the Old Red Lion Theatre.
Mm.
Were you angry?
No. Not really. No, I just enjoying Joe suddenly turning into a caller into 606. There,
it's all a little bit that, wasn't it? Yeah.
I can't really. This is one of those. There are a number of sort of topics in the world that I am very happy not to have an opinion and just to kind of sit back and, you know, watch differing opinions like Joe has expressed there. This isn't, I mean, this doesn't make ideal fodder for a topical football podcast, but I don't really care. No.
Well, fine then. I mean, I think it's ridiculous also, but what we should do is look at how ridiculously good Thomas Tuchel has made Chelsea very quickly. I can't remember a manager having such a massive impact in the way he has. Seb, can you prove me wrong?
No, I completely agree with you. But I approach it from a slightly different way, JJ. I just think, how does Frank Lampard ever get another job? He took, because you can say, right, well, that team that won the European Cup, he had them in what, eighth or something, or ninth?
Yeah, I think it was ninth he took him over in, yeah.
Couldn't get a tune out of Havertz, couldn't defend, managed to concede three times at West Brom. And that was a European Cup winning team by the end of it. Hey, you know what was really impressive is the bit about surviving Anfield with 10 men. Because like even with 11, like previously, how often have we seen Liverpool crank the pressure up to such an extent that teams start to make mistakes, teams start to kind of, their systems start to fail without the ball. And part of that is Liverpool have declined a little bit. They're not quite what they were, or they're not quite at where they were at this point in time. But Chelsea was so impressive in the second half. And there's a resilience and a kind of togetherness that not only do you not really associate with Chelsea, because they're not the club of battling spirit, are they? I don't think that's the kind of the place they occupy in people's imagination. But also when you've come into a club like that after 7 or 8 months to forge all of these things that you need to survive in that scenario are really, really impressive. It's what you'd expect after you win a Champions League. I accept that. But it's still one of those where if that happens to you, and I think we've kind of covered the various issues about the red card, but you can feel a bit hard done by, you can have a bit of a sulk. I think there's a little bit of a collective loss of discipline before halftime. Antonio Rudiger got yellow carded. Tuchel himself had a little bit of a rage at the fourth official. And those kind of things, they can fray the fibers in a football team. And you can go out into the second half and you can have lost the game within 10 or 15 minutes and that's that. And no one would have had much of a problem with it. But they dug in and they came away with it. And I think it was super impressive. And I don't know, I feel like there's another side to it. I feel like there's a way of analyzing what Liverpool are as well off the back of it. I felt a little bit shortchanged. It might have been just because the game was so good in the first half, but I was expecting something a little bit better.
I was going to ask you half-time. Whether Liverpool are, or how good Liverpool is and will be, but I'm going to do that question after a short break. And we're back. So Seb, please tell me how many, or how is, when are, how good are Liverpool this season?
JJ, I do not know. I'm not sure. I wonder because I don't know whether there's been a pronounced decline in Liverpool or whether they just haven't been able to go and buy a new £100 million forward. I don't know what's fair at this point because I think there's a little bit of a natural falling off for them. I don't think they're quite where they were in 2019 or 2020. I think that's fair.
Does it reflect at all kind of Klopp's Borussia Dortmund teams?
No, I don't think so because obviously Liverpool have achieved a lot more achieved a lot more in Europe than those Borussia Dortmund teams did. They actually got over the line. Also, when the end came for Klopp at Dortmund, it was much more dramatic. It was more of a, it felt like more of a fracturing rather than a kind of a gentle, you know, a sort of a sliding down the other side of the summit sort of feel. Whereas I think that, and I follow quite a few Liverpool fans on Twitter who say this, I think they haven't done a great job of refreshing that squad. Their succession planning hasn't quite been good enough. And there's actually a story in The Athletic, exclusively in The Athletic today, broken by David Ornstein, or just David Ornstein.
You're saying that, Uncle Damien Ornstein? Were you putting two characters together there?
I've got the red line in my head. It's, you know, it's
a great pub.
I spent a long time there over the summer, so it's kind of also was in the office quite a bit. So the two things have just merged, David Ornstein and the odd red line. And Uncle Damien, anyway, between those three things, it's being claimed that Michael Edwards, the sporting director, is leaving the club at the end of the season.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Ellipsis.
Mm. So interesting, in fact, that I want to now talk about Burnley 1-1 Leeds. Joe Devine, Burnley seemed to me to be very, 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 very aggressive. But are they too aggressive?
You've taken my only point. No, I watched this game.
No.
I watched most of this game.
You're kidding.
They're not too aggressive. Burnley? You think they're too aggressive?
Yes.
No, they're good fun.
I don't think they're any more aggressive than they have been kind of
really?
Before.
I feel like I've noticed a big jump.
No, really? I think
interesting.
I think maybe what you're noticing, is they're pressing more. I think I feel like I haven't watched Burnley enough over the last couple of years to be able to categorically say that this is true. And maybe we'll ask Alex, or you can check next time. Next time, you know.
I know about Burnley.
You know, fine, whatever. Why have you asked me?
Because you're doing my job today.
They pressed extremely heavily in this game. The interesting thing for me watching it as a sort of layman was my expectation is I sit down, I watch Leeds sort of not necessarily hammer Burnley in the scoreline, but hammer them on the pitch, you know, try to win the ball back high.
As they're being kicked off it.
I expect to see a lot of longer balls. I expect to see a relatively open game because of the way that I expect both teams to play, or the ball moving back and forth quite a lot. And what I actually saw was Leeds attempting to play out from the back, and Burnley pressing quite narrowly and quite high and aggressively and winning the ball back high up the pitch. It didn't translate into the goals that I suppose that they would have hoped that it would. But I watched it thinking, this is a smart tactical decision. And I know that Burnley are a smart tactical team. I think they can be reduced to aggressive and kicking other players off the pitch and whatever. But having watched some TIFO videos about Burnley in the past and having sort of chatted about what Sean Dyche has done with that team, as I said, I think they're often unfairly reduced. They played an extremely sensible tactic in this game, which was a little bit different from what they would normally do. They adjusted, and that is not something that we associate with Burnley. I thought they did a good job. I did also think their striker, whose name I'm now forgetting.
Ashley Barnes, Chris Wood.
Ashley Barnes, thank you. Ashley Barnes was a tad over the top.
Just think he was?
Just a little bit. Just as if, you know, when you...
You almost sent him into the shadow realm.
When you leave the hob on in the kitchen, leave the room, and then you hear this, come back just in time to turn it down. Just a little bit of overspill.
Yeah.
He's very bumpy. He was a very, very bumpy. I think I tweeted as saying he reminds me of a very bumpy Wands player in Rocket League. Quite annoying to play against, and occasionally not as effective as you would want them to be. But the main thing I took from the game really is I don't really understand this Leeds team at the moment. I feel like this is a game I wouldn't necessarily expect them to win, but would expect them to put in a performance which would make me think that they should have won. And that didn't happen in the game. I know that they had a lot more of the ball in the second half, and I know that I missed a lot of the second half. But with those two things taken into account, the parts of it that I did see, they didn't look like a dominant team. And I'm not sure what to expect from them now this season. I wonder if that'll be something we'll talk about more in a few weeks' time if they don't up their game.
I think we'll look at Burnley on IRL and probably Leeds as well at some point. TIFO IRL, yeah. It is on YouTube. Leeds, I think, are just getting warmed up, and I think it's hard for any team, no matter how good you are, if you are being pummeled by Burnley. I think Burnley are really clever tactically, and the way they've been able to stay in the Premier League all this time is because of very smart management, great coaching. They sign particular players to fit the particular style, like the particular brand of football. And I understand there's nothing wrong with that. But some of the challenges they put in are things that would cause rammies on Sunday League, I think, genuinely. Like, really too strong.
I don't know. Maybe.
100%. Mm. Barnes going in for that, like, scissor, like Chun Li spinning round trying to take him out.
Sure.
That
one was over the top.
But there's loads of examples.
I think the points we made, and we can draw another Rocket League analogy here. Within the Rocket League communities, I'm sure some listeners will be aware, there is a sort of there's a line of thought which suggests that bumping players and demoing when your car bashes into another car instead of attempting to go for the ball as a pure football or pure Rocket League player would is not a real tactic and is rude or is toxic within the game. Whereas my opinion is, it's the best tactic. If you bump into someone when they're not expecting, if you don't let them do whatever they want, they can't do whatever they want.
That's exactly what the tactic is.
That's the perfect thing to do. If they're better than you, skill-wise, then just push them. It works really well. And I think people get very upset about it, and I certainly get upset when a pushy ones player gets all bumpy with me. But after I've had some time to calm down and I've apologised to the people in my immediate vicinity, I can respect that bumpy ones player for doing what they should do, you know? And that's what I think of Burnley.
Well, let's go to happier times. And Tottenham 1-0 Watford, because Seb, that team you like, is top of the league.
Top of the league with a few asterisks. Hasn't been the most attractive, and there are a few gaps in that team which either need to be filled or very, very well disguised. But it's been good. It's been a couple of people have drawn parallels with Jose Mourinho, but then what I'd say is, yes, it's exactly like that, just without all the hatred and all the goals being conceded. Like, so it's not really like that at all.
He looks right, doesn't he? Don't you think he looks right in the chair? I didn't think he would look right, but he does look right in the chair.
Funny thing about Nuno is he's quite charismatic. He's people don't think this because his press conferences are notoriously boring. If you sit there, he's one of those, he's a little bit of a Pulis in the sense that he has no time for the theater of the press conference. He just wants to go in, bore everyone to tears and then leave. But he's quite an interesting guy. And he's when he's in a good mood, he's someone that you can imagine players gravitating towards. But it's been, I tell you what's been most appealing about it is that one of the problems last year and for a little bit of the season before that was that Tottenham never looked fit enough. And so they had a strategy, which is pretty well publicized under Mourinho, to find an early goal if they could, take a lead and then sit back and play almost solely off the counterattack. And the problem used to be is that they would get sort of towards the last quarter of a game, look knackered, someone would make a mental mistake and the whole strategy would just fall to pieces. It does seem this season, even though it's only been three games, that this team is better conditioned and there's a little bit more cohesion. And also some of the players have recovered from being Mourinho'd. I think that his habit of pointing fingers and telling individual players that they are not very good, maverick strategy that is, I think that damaged quite a few of them. So Davinson Sanchez has greatly improved. He was a catastrophe for most of last season. Looks reborn. Eric Dyer's played very, very well. You know, you see the sort of the, you know, after like there's been a, you know, an apocalypse and the ground is scorched and everything's
on
fire.
Yeah, we all know after there's been an apocalypse.
Yeah, yeah. I see them all the time, yeah.
Very familiar.
There's no signs of life. Well, this is, at this stage, I think we've discovered a few trees, like, you know, some marine-based wildlife swimming around. You're thinking,
oh, look over there. There's a Davinson
this
Sanchez.
Is, right. So there's a long way to go. There aren't any buildings. There's no running water. And we haven't actually constructed any sort of industry or forms of government. But it's better. And you feel a little bit better about being in the environment.
How does this work? No, that's too negative.
Maybe all the woodland creatures could come into the stadium and feast upon the excellent grass that they've built. Although it does have
plastic. It's really nice grass.
Don't eat the grass.
More importantly, listen, there's going to be a drop-off. I think that's very clear. September and October are going to be very tricky for Spurs given their fixtures. But it's a really nice start and it's the beginning of something different. I don't know what that something actually is, but it's a direction. Players seem to be buying into it. The Kane thing is over for the next 8 months. Presumably that won't come back until next summer. So it all feels a little bit fresher and that's really nice. And it's enjoyable again because it's also, the focus seems to be on what the team are doing rather than just what the individual guy in control of the team is saying or, you know, how he's behaving. And that's kind of refreshing, but it was good. Nice goal. Well done. 3 out of 3.
And I thought it was interesting, Joe, that you said that Nuno just looked right in the chair. Like he just fit it. It all made a lot more sense as though that business in particular was running much better with a change of person in the chair, almost like you could say the Tifo Football Podcast. I am being very...
For a moment in my head there, I thought, oh, that's nice. JJ's noticed I've said an interesting thing. I'm offering a little bit more of a kind of cultural, you know, viewer role. He's going to bring... He thought that we need more of this, but actually you weren't valuing me at all. You were devaluing me and de-skilling me, yes. And you were in my chair. And guess what? I'm bored of this now, so I'm going...
Oh, don't go again. Joe's actually gone again. This seems to be a thing he likes to do in podcasts now, and we just have to accept it because he is in charge. So, Wolves 0-1 Manchester United. What do we think of this game, Nick? Was it good? Are Manchester United good?
In order, yes, and I don't know. Is this the... I don't want to bring up Cristiano Ronaldo again, but I'm going to bring up Cristiano Ronaldo again.
Let's do it. It's probably quite an important one of the big things that happened this week, so we should reference that.
Yeah, this kind of signing him makes no logical sense for Manchester United, but that is kind of if you assume that Manchester United are a sort of logical football club, whereas they seem to be almost entirely run by emotions, keeping bringing Ronaldo back and keeping Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in charge. They have been sort of reasonably decent over the last sort of couple of years, really, by basically having a few good players who will at some points do something good, almost as a sort of almost despite the environment and the system in which they're playing in. And so by that kind of weird, slightly twisted, nonsensical logic, so having someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, who is not a player that really kind of lends himself to a system, or not anymore anyway, that really lends himself to a system and just is around to do things, it almost makes you think that this might work, because you know they just have a lot of these players now that they can just, and if you stick enough of them on the pitch, then things will happen at some point.
Yeah,
which was kind of sort of what happened in this game. I mean, you know, Mason Greenwood gets the ball on the right and cuts in, and keeper probably should have saved the shot. But you know, if you have enough good players, you can just chuck them on the pitch and they'll do something. Well,
this is
eventually.
The weird secret of football is that the best players tend to win most of the matches.
Yeah,
but they don't always make for the best team. And I'm trying to think, this sort of strategy of buying the best individual players seems to be something they were getting away from a little bit. But I mean, look at Real. I think the closest example I can think of is that Real Madrid team that won Champions League but 3 times in a row, just with great individuals, maybe not a particular system. It was just that Zidane found a way to get them all to function properly in the same way. And then Zidane's not often thought of as some great tactical mind, but he did then win the Champions League. Was it 3 years in a row?
Yeah.
Was that right?
Yes. Yes, it was. I think it was. But yeah, I mean, a logical football club would have said, well, no, we're not, you know, spending an awful lot of money on this 36-year-old who doesn't really fit into our system. We'll buy a defensive midfielder instead. But Manchester United aren't logical. Cristiano Ronaldo isn't a logical signing. But somehow, two illogical things could come together to make something a little bit more logical. I don't know. This could all be nonsense. But
I think Nick's right, though, because the thing about the emotion is really interesting, because if you read the account of how this actually happened, then there's a lot of outside people influencing it. So according to the reporting, Sir Alex Ferguson got involved, called Ronaldo, Rio Ferdinand got involved, Patrice Evra got involved. Like, these are all people that are inextricably linked to Manchester United's past and what Manchester United are. But it's a, well, we want him so that nobody else has him, because... And that seems what it's based on. Like, the Real Madrid thing is a pretty good example. And do you remember that, well, Zidane also had Casemiro there, and Manchester United are trying to do things with McFred. Like, I think Scott McTominay is a better player than he's given credit for. I also think Fred is, but I don't think they're anywhere near the kind of the level that you need them to be to go and actually do something, to actually achieve something tangible. And it's just a really weird allocation of resources. It feels like a decision that somebody's made with, like, it's one of the decisions that someone has to make within 60 seconds. Like, someone phoned up Ed Woodward and said, this is happening, but you don't have more than a minute to consider it. And he was like, and then someone said, but Manchester City might do it if you don't. And he was like, okay, do it. Fine.
See, do you think there's any of the big positive parts of it? I understand the logic of exactly what you're saying with the squad building and stuff. There's something Roy Keane said I thought was really interesting, and I agree with it. Is that you bring someone like Ronaldo, an elite, one of the best players of all time, into that environment, and then players like Greenwood, Rashford, they see how the absolute elite train, how they look after themselves, and they bring a certain level of professionalism, determination maybe, and also just pure skill level. Like, he'll be hitting shots into the bottom corner every single time in training, I assume. And that can only benefit them in training and makes them better as a team, surely?
But who... Okay, if you think about sort of Roy Keane's generation or the teams that were constructed before and after him,
yeah.
Like, who fulfilled that role really among that group?
Cantona,
they didn't need it. What's that?
Not Cantona.
No, but Cantona was in his 20s when he joined Man United, not like sort of a veteran player at the end of his career who's sort of after one more big contract. I'm not saying Ronaldo's not still a really fabulous player. He's brilliant, clearly. But
I think Keane's example was Stuart Pearce at Forest that he saw. He just saw the level that these top
But then again... Yeah, I get that. But Stuart Pearce, when Roy Keane was playing with Stuart Pearce, Stuart Pearce wasn't 38. 36. I mean, it's different. It's kind of, if you bring a world-class player into an environment and they are still absolutely the top of the game, I get the aspirational thing. But then the other half of it is, okay, Ronaldo's signed a contract. I'd be very surprised if there weren't some assurances about game time in that contract regarding the Premier League and the Champions League. And yesterday we saw another little glimpse of just what a good player Mason Greenwood is. And also, like, those players, I know they're not quite the same level, but they have Edison Cavani there. He's a veteran player to achieve things in the game. He's a good professional.
Just signed a new deal to stick around to be the main number nine, and suddenly they've brought...
It's a weird one. It feels like, fans will get excited about it, I'm sure about that, but it feels like it was done so that he wouldn't go to City.
Which there is, firstly, I
get that too.
There is an awful lot of logic, I think, to, as stupid and infantile as it may initially seem, of not, of signing someone just so Manchester City don't get him. Because, you know, what United, it's just money. They're just paying him money. It doesn't really matter to them. And if, you know, it costs them however much it is, 20 million in transfer fee and same again in wages, then that's probably worth the money to not for so that Manchester City don't have him. Where it slightly falls down is then you actually have to find a way to put him in your team.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, referencing this actual game, so a team that could probably have done with someone like Ronaldo, I mean, everyone could, is Wolves, who seem to not be able to score goals. Now, that's bad, Seb, isn't it?
It's not good. It's not a good trait, football teams not scoring goals. But it's slightly baffling because they're creating really good chances. And actually, rather than a sort of collective level of haplessness, Sunday, they were just very unlucky. I mean, they ran into a couple of good saves from the goalkeeper, a brilliant goal on clearance from Aaron Wan-Bissaka at one point, a little bit of bad finishing, yes, but I've enjoyed watching Wolves so much. I mean, great. That group of players, when Traore and Trincao and Raul Jimenez are all on form, but they're all kind of orbiting around each other, it's great to watch.
I've not seen this game. How did Trincao get on? Because I mean, he looked great at Barcelona maybe even last season. How's he adjusted?
He looked pretty good. I mean, he looked pretty good as the whole forward line did until they got to about 20 yards from goal. And they just seemed to have a kind of collective existential crisis when they got that close to the goal. They looked fantastic up until that point. And, you know, there were a few occasions, particularly in the first half, which sort of, if United would have lost this game, it would have thoroughly backed up the idea that they need to sign a defensive midfielder, because there was a couple of times where Traore just ran directly through the middle of the pitch and directly through the section of the pitch where there should have been a sort of competent defensive midfielder. But then you could almost see when he got to around the D, where he was just like, okay, I'm not really sure what to do here. And I think Trincao was a little bit like that. Raul Jimenez doesn't look quite at it just yet, which is, you know, understandable given the what he's come back from. They've had 57 shots in their three games, haven't scored a goal. Only Liverpool and Man City have taken more shots. I don't know about Trincao. Traore is not going to change, I don't think. This is what he does. So they're kind of putting an awful lot. And I know this is you could boil this down to a team hopes the good players that they have play well, but they're putting an awful lot on Raul Jimenez becoming or going back to how good he was before his injury. And given the nature of the injury, that's, you know, it's quite a big if.
Oh, I mean, the very idea of him having to go and contest any sort of headers.
Yeah.
I don't know how a man gets over that. It's incredible.
No, I mean, it's probably a really interesting piece in this if they, you know, they would talk about this in the, not just the physical, but the psychological, you know, recovery and the treatment that Jimenez has had to go through over the last, you know, what is it? No, it's not quite a year because, yeah, like you say, he, the idea of even going up for a header, not just kind of, you know, heading the ball. I mean, heading the ball itself would be, I would be terrified enough of that.
We did a podcast with Ian Hume about a year ago,
maybe six or seven months ago.
And it was really interesting because he was talking, obviously, for those who don't know, Ian Hume suffered a fractured skull playing against Chris Morgan, I think back in 2006. And he said when he came back to training, when he headed a ball, he found his teammates' reaction to it was weirder than his, because everyone basically felt as we do, that how can you go back to heading a ball or contesting for a header, defending a corner, these kind of things. But the way he described it was he just, I mean, people go back and listen to the episode. Ian's very, very interesting on this issue. But he was very forthright and matter of fact. That was his career. It was his living. He lived the game, didn't want anything else. He just managed to, he had the mental strength just to get on with it because he had no choice and he wanted to carry on in the sport. I don't know, like I look at, this might be a really stupid observation, but the thing he wears, the protective thing, is, would that not make you feel, I'm trying to imagine how I would feel playing football in something like that. I remember Wayne Rooney, when he got a cut around his hairline or something, and he was wearing it whilst on England duty. And it wasn't even like one of those rugby scrum caps that you see. It was bigger. It was like a sort of, it was more of a helmet. And it's just going to feel very, very strange. Like, not only just running around, but also controlling the ball, going for a header. If you're wearing something like that, surely it gets much, much harder to put the reason for wearing that out of your mind.
Oh, I see. Yes. Because you're constantly aware of it because it's there. You can't forget.
Yeah. There's like, it marks you out. There was, he's just left Hamburg actually, but there was a guy called, I forget his first name, his surname is Jasula. And he wore a protective hat, which looked like he looks like a medieval knight in it. it's really different. It's not like one of those. It's not like a Petacek one. It is more like something you'd see at a joust. It's very, very strange. And so you have this bizarre appearance, which must be odd for your opponents and for the way that they treat you when they're contesting a ball. Like if Nick and I are going for a header and he's wearing that on his head, if I'm a decent human being, I'm a little bit reticent about what I'm doing. I think.
What about if Nick was wearing a full suit of armor?
No, if he's wearing a full suit of armor, I clatter him. He's fine. He'd be okay. He'll be able to deal with that. But it's a, I don't know. It just must alter the parameters of competition a little bit, I would have thought.
What if I was on a horse as well? Would you
knock you off?
I like that, but I think, I mean, it changes the dynamic of the game of football if one of you is on a horse. I can understand this suit of armor for protection to try and win a header.
Really impact my pace, which is already
it would impact
poor.
Pace would go down from 99 to 10.
Yeah. Yeah. How many is 99 out of if you're measuring my pace here?
Well, speaking of a player who has pace probably not of 1,000 or 99, but a bit slower now because he's a bit older, is Lionel Messi, who is the best player I have ever seen. I love him very much. And he played on Sunday. He played for PSG. Against Rennes. Is that how you say it? Am I close? I'm going to go with that. I'm sorry if it's wrong. Rennes 0 to PSG. I watched this game. There's a bit that I thought was excellent in his notes. It says, as soon as Messi came on, PSG seemed to revert to some kind of circus mode.
It means that they suddenly became very aware. It's like, oh, well, you know, we've got Messi in our team now. We have to play in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I thought PSG were largely good in this game. And they were quite cutting and nice moves, scored a very nice second goal. And then Messi comes on, and first you had Neymar glaring at the pitch and being a little bit upset, having been taken off, which was just fabulous Sunday night entertainment. But then it all became very, oh, we've watched a few Barcelona games on TV, so we know how to play. And you're like, well, no, you don't, because they spent like 15 years training to do that, and Messi did as well. So
that's interesting you said that. That's exactly what I saw as well. And I thought they were rushing the passes. They were making, they weren't making this extra pass kind of thing Pep Guardiola often talks about, is you need to make an extra pass to be able to be in the right position to make those forced passes through to him. But they were just trying to get it through as though thinking, I mean, he's a little genius, little magician, but you can't, if you've got three players around you, even, you know, he is still a human being, so he can't do these things all the time.
There was also a couple of the players that he was playing against. There was kind of split between those who are a little bit in awe of him and those who were, I'm not going to become part of a highlight. And he just thought, anytime he went past him, there was one guy who Messi gave a pass off to, I think it might have been Mbappe, possibly Ashraf Hakimi. And he cut in and he ran towards the D. And one of the defenders just grabs him around the neck.
Oh, yeah.
And you just see his face. You just think, oh, I don't know if I've done the right thing here. I don't, can I, could I have done without this at this point in my career?
This is such an obvious thing to say, and everyone will say it, but it felt really weird seeing him in a different shirt. It just doesn't seem real. It's like, I just want him to go back to Barcelona for in a weird way.
Yeah, and he, this is almost certainly sort of projecting, but he looked a bit uncomfortable as well.
Yeah,
he, it was like he was kind of, I don't know, it felt like, and this is sort of partly an analogy, partly kind of what actually happened. But if you've ever been in a room with a bunch of people and then someone really famous walks in, everyone just kind of, everyone's attention is focused on them. And that was what,
podcast today when you came in.
Exactly. Yeah. The everyone's attention gravitated towards this kind of beacon of charisma that was now in the studio.
Yeah.
So which is, you know, very much like Messi, and this will, presumably this will be what it stays like for a long time. I think it's quite interesting that a lot's been made of the I think the goalkeeper who had a picture, he got Messi to take a picture of his son, which you can get very kind of proper football man about this and say, you know, he's supposed to be competing with him. This isn't some kind of sideshow, whatever. But what I thought was more interesting was the Rams, I'm not sure, president said before the game how he hoped that the home fans kind of stood up and cheered Messi. This kind of feeds into this slightly odd, well, I find it slightly odd anyway, idea that ever since the Qataris came in at PSG, I would have thought that the entirety of Ligue 1 would have been kind of thoroughly put out by this and annoyed that they are effectively have been put within no chance of winning everything.
Yeah.
Because they will just hoover up any decent players that any of them might come across. But I interviewed the president of Nice, I think, a few years ago, and he was sort of sincerely very positive about the idea. He goes, well, no, this is great because, you know, it'll raise the level of the whole division and it'll bring loads of more attention to Liga, and we will benefit from increased TV revenues and increased gate receipts and all this kind of thing, which, you know, as it turns out, logically, apart from the sort of the snafu with the TV rights thing last season, but it has kind of worked out. I think they would have usually expected about sort of 10,000-12,000 at that game last night. Turns out after Messi was announced, they sold out all their tickets.
I bet the numbers for viewing it as well were much higher.
Yeah,
I mean, I watched it for a start.
Yeah, exactly. But it seems sort of slightly counterintuitive that that the other teams would welcome this kind of behemoth suddenly appearing in their division, and I suppose Messi signing is the sort of logical extreme of that. That, you know, this kind of incredibly glamorous and wealthy club have signed probably the greatest player that's ever been, and everyone is delighted about it, rather than this being another symbol of this completely imbalanced and quite, you know, possibly morally repugnant club existing in their division.
But one of the things I thought, we'll move on from this, but I thought Peel described it as being like the Harlem Globetrotters. That's what PSG are a bit like. And this was the most, like, the best example of that I could possibly see. It just felt like there was a Hollywood movie star who'd come in. And that's what the whole, even the game felt like a build up to Messi coming on rather than anything else, which is odd. He's bigger than the club, really. It's kind of odd, but I mean, maybe we'll change with that. I think we should do one more game. And Seb, I'd like it if you told me about Atletico 2-2 Villarreal, because something very bad happened at the end of this game.
Yeah, well, first of all, really good game. Great fun. Just sometimes those Sunday night games can be a little bit soporific. You sort of find yourself thinking, God, I think I might have had enough football. And you're just sitting there and thinking, if I could be bothered to go to bed, I would just turn the TV off now. But this was great. It was full of energy and life, and Atletico were great. But they fell behind twice, equalized once, And their second equaliser is a 95th minute of injury time. A ball sort of drops in behind the defence. Defender goes to head it back to his goalkeeper. Goalkeeper has moved probably a little bit far to his left to accommodate the flight of the ball. And it's not that the defender just heads the ball past him. It's that he heads the ball past him at a very agonising pace. And the goalkeeper should still obviously save it before it goes in. And when you, as the ball crosses the line and Villarreal realise that they've thrown away two valuable points, the whole environment becomes like a Renaissance painting. And you have people sort of like flat on their face, devastated. And it, not just on the pitch, because you see that all the time, like defenders just collapsing and, you know, head and hands and stuff. But there's a great picture of Unai Emery. And next to him, there's some, I don't know who he is, but some Villarreal assistant that's just flat down on the floor.
It was sort of Bayern Munich 1989 levels of kind of absolute
but without any of the energy. Like no one's beating their fists. No one's doing a Sami Kafur. People just... it's just ended them. And it's complete devastation. And it's one of the, okay, it's the beginning of the season. This wasn't really a game that mattered for anything beyond a couple of points, but it's one of the most devastating ways to throw away points I've ever seen. It's been awful.
Yeah. I mean, in context, that Atletico are basically the title favourites, wouldn't they be this season, maybe?
I would say so. They're the best. They're the best of the few rounds we've had so far. Like, they're the best Spanish team, I'd say. And last night they played, Sunday night, sorry, they played with an intensity of champions. They look great. And they were better than Real Madrid. Barcelona bored me to tears. That's the kind of the converse of the PSG situation. We've all got so used to just being able to turn on the channel and watching Messi and Barca and being pretty much guaranteed that something cool is going to happen, like something of a really high quality is going to reward you. And I watched it, and it was slow and pedestrian and dire, and it was just I just turned it off. I just couldn't be bothered. But Atletico looked very good, and did not lose thanks to a catastrophe, and I mean catastrophe in proper emphasis. It was just it's excruciating to watch.
I'm sure you can find it on the internet. There's lots of stuff there, and also Alex of Tifo did a great breakdown of how Atletico's system has changed away from that 4-4-2 we associate with Atletico to something else. And to find out what that is, you can go to the video on Tifo IRL and see it. And I believe that that's probably the best way to end it, by plugging Alex's video on Tifo IRL. So yes, we've had a lot of laughs. Joe was here and then he left halfway through. And he'll be hosting next week, won't he? That's good. Everything goes back to normal then. I can relax. Okay, so going to say thanks to Nick Miller for...
Thank you. And we could do this for hours.
Pleasure is all mine.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Pleasure's all mine. And to you, Seb, who I love talking to. There we go.
Thank you, JJ Bull.
Nice way to end. Okay, Joe will be back next week properly. And that's it. So thanks for listening and have a lovely time.
The Athletic.